Well, good morning. You've never seen a sermon start quite that way before, have you? Well, good morning. My name is George Davis. I want to do a quick survey. And watching that video, how many would say there was something in the video I agreed with? Just be honest. Okay? And how many would say, and you can raise your hand again, there was something in that video that really annoyed me? Well, good. That was the intended effect. So part of the reason we put that video together the way we did was we wanted to kind of represent a microcosm of what our country has experienced and is experiencing political in recent weeks, days, and months, particularly through this last election season. The Gallup poll has found that 77% of us in America believe that our nation is deeply divided on issues of value and that are important to us. And that is the highest number they have ever received when they have asked certain polling questions. On a personal level, I think the truth during this recent election cycle has been many of us have had interactions in conversation, interactions on social media, that were at times frustrating, combative, even painful. Recently, I had coffee with a friend, and we were talking about politics, and he was just describing some of the realities, and he said this. He said, "I'm so angry, and I don't know why." One of the ways this has played out has been in our families and between multiple generations. In many ways, this political experience we've gone through has divided us generationally. Some of you have experienced that personally. This week, a friend sent me a column that came out of the Village Voice magazine, and a young man had written in, and he wrote these words, "I'm writing because I just can't deal with my father anymore. He's ruining our relationship and our planet with his politics." We laugh, but some of you have been there. Some of you in family conversations, you don't get your grandparents' generation. You don't get how they can support certain candidates or political ideas. Maybe you're at the other end of the spectrum. You don't get your kids who are now growing up and have their own ideas. You don't get your young adult children or even your grandchildren. And this has been a point of contention. And maybe it was even the case at different points, particularly through this last election cycle, that it was like, there's certain things we can't talk about in our house. But even that was painful because even though you didn't talk about them, you knew the disagreement was there, and it was just right under the surface, right? It's kind of the elephant in the room that is never addressed. And not only did we experience this in our families, many of us experience this in other relationships that are important to us. Some of you experience this in relationships with other people right here in the church. I can't read this person's Facebook post anymore. They just make me angry. One person told me, I've had hard conversations in relationships that matter to me deeply over politics in the last year. In different ways, we have experienced this frustration. So here's the question. How do I get along with someone who is politically different from me? How do I get along with someone who is politically different than me? How do I engage those conversations? What do I do on social media? What about those Facebook posts? What about those emails that are forwarded to me? How do I deal with those kinds of interactions? This morning, we're going to begin a new series that's going to take us for 5 weeks called We All Have Questions. Earlier this year, we invited you just to submit questions of things you would like us to talk about, and we got a lot of response. Thank you for that. And we kind of categorize those into different categories. We obviously can't deal with all of them, but we're going to try to hit some of the major categories. And one of the major categories was just this whole issue of politics. So we're going to talk about this morning. Here are the other questions we're going to deal with in this series. Next week, in terms of possessions, when is enough enough? We had questions about money. The 20th, how do I relate to those who feel Christianity is judgmental? The 27th, why do I find it hard to spend meaningful time with God? You know, Georgia, around here, we spend a lot of time talking about living with Jesus. That's foundational to our life as a church. We want to help people live with Jesus, but it's so easy to do other things. So Why is it so hard for me to spend meaningful time with God? And then September 3rd is going to be very different. That's a family service for us. And we're calling it Ask Pastor George because that Sunday I'm going to answer questions that have been submitted by kids in our Kid Step program. In fact, you may not notice this, but over the last couple of weeks, I've actually had my own mailbox in Kid Step. I think already we've gotten over 50 questions from kids, and your kids ask some interesting questions. I can't wait to share them with you. You need to be here. I promise I won't reveal the names. I may point, but I won't reveal the names. So this is where we are going over these next few weeks. And then following that, on September 10th, we're actually going to begin a series I'm really looking forward to, working through the book of Ephesians. But this morning, how do we deal with people who differ from us politically? How do I engage those conversations? How do I think about politics? Now, obviously, in the course of this series, we want to address these specific questions, but I hope also you understand another goal of this series is just to remind us as a church community, church needs to be a place where we can have honest, open conversations about hard stuff and seek to address them from a biblical perspective, right? That's why we use the couch kind of as an image for this series because, you just sit down and you talk on the couch and you have honest conversation. And so I want you to know that if in the course of this, that if there's things I say that just you've got other conversations and you'd like to continue the conversation, just contact me. gdavis@hersheyfree.com is the best way to track me down, and we can have that conversation, and we may even end up moving some of these conversations onto Facebook if that would be helpful. So understand that in some sense, this can be a conversation. But let's dive into this first question. How do I engage those who differ with me politically? I realize some of the historical realities we are facing seem very new right now. For instance, it's only been since 2000 that we have used the language of red state and blue state. And it seems within the last 20 years, our nation, at least in terms of political rhetoric, has become more divided. But even though all of this seems very recent, believe it or not, there's actually a scene in the life of Jesus that I think can be helpful to us. So if you've got a Bible, I'm going to ask you to join with me in turning to Matthew chapter 22. By the way, as you're turning there, let me just highlight again our time together as a church community, just celebrating baptism. That's just a great moment in the life of our church. So if that can be a part of your schedule this afternoon, I'd love to see you there. So that's coming up later today. So Matthew 22, I want to begin in verse 15. Here's the scene. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him, that is Jesus, in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Come on, show me the coin. Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him a denarius. And he asked them, whose image is this? Whose inscription? Well, Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. When they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him and went away. Now, as each of the gospel writers, three of the gospel writers tell this account, it's very clear this is a trap, right? But initially, this may seem a little bit odd to you because we've got the idea of these people kind of huddling together. Let's figure out how we can trap Jesus. I know. Let's ask him about tax policy. That always gets people in trouble, right? Just get anyone, a public figure, to talk about tax policy. I mean, this may seem like a little bit of an odd conversation, but you need to understand. This was a brilliant trap. I mean, this is an absolutely clever but deeply devious trap that is set for Jesus. To show you what I mean, let me just kind of fill in on some of the details, the historical background, so you kind of get a full picture of what's going on. So let's just step into the story for a moment. And here's what you need to understand. The language, the vocabulary that is used in this text implies that most likely that we're not talking just about any tax. We're talking particularly about the imperial tax. It was a head tax, a poll tax. Now, scholars estimate that it's quite likely that that people were paying upwards of 40%, maybe even more, of their income in taxes at this time. And this tax wasn't a lot of money, but it was highly controversial. And it was controversial for this reason. You see, this is a tax Rome instituted in the areas that it controlled. And what was controversial about this tax was its symbolic nature, because what this tax symbolized was this: you are subject to Caesar. And when it was instituted in 6 AD, it became very controversial in Israel. In fact, at that time, a guy by the name of Judas the Galilean, he leads a revolt. And his argument is simple. We can't pay this tax. We're the people of God. We're not ultimately under Caesar. We can't recognize Caesar as Lord and Master. We must revolt against this. We must have our people in charge. We must bring about God's kingdom. We are not part of Caesar's kingdom. And so 20 plus years before this conversation takes place, Judas the Galilean leads a revolt. And adding fuel to the fire is this fact. Due to religious sensibilities, coins that were minted in Israel never carried a human image. But to pay the imperial poll tax, you had to use an imperial coin, a denarius that was minted at an imperial mint. And this is what that coin looked like. It carried the image of Tiberius Caesar, and it carried the inscription that said he is the son of the divine Augustus. And on the reverse side, it carries the inscription that he is our high priest. To a faithful Jew, this is blasphemy. In fact, there were Jews in Jesus' day that argued, you can't even carry around that coin and be faithful to our beliefs. So this isn't a simple question, right, about tax policy. This is a political power keg. Now, of course, Judas was quickly snuffed out by the Romans, but those embers of revolt would continue to simmer right under the surface, and they would finally gain full flame 30 years after Jesus in an all-out revolt we know as the Zealot Revolt. And so when these guys come to Jesus and they say, what do you think? Do we pay the tax or not? It's not just a question about tax policy. They are looking at Jesus and saying this: are you a revolutionary? In so many ways, you sound like Judas the Galilean, who talked about the fact that we are under God's reign. Is that what you are saying? And when you think about it, it is an absolutely brilliant trap. Because if Jesus says, no, don't pay the tax, then obviously he's a revolutionary too. He's guilty of insurrection. And Rome will snuff him out. If he says, yes, just pay the tax, then he has quickly aligned himself with the political establishment. And it turns out all of that stuff about kingdom of God and what God is doing now, all of that is just empty political rhetoric. And the expectation is over time his popularity will simply drain away. It's a perfect trap. He's in trouble either way. So how does Jesus handle it? Well, once again, he does the unexpected, right? He doesn't immediately answer the question. Instead, he says, okay, who's got one of these coins? And there's a little bit of humor here because I can just envision somebody looking around, oh, shoot, I've got one, right? I don't really want to admit I'm carrying it around, but okay, here you go. And he says, so whose picture is that? Whose inscription? Whose image? Well, Caesar's. We'll get back to Caesar, what is Caesar's, and to God, what is God's. And obviously, it's an unexpected answer because the people are amazed and just walk away dumbfounded. But in this unexpected answer, there are three things that Jesus avoids. And what I want to suggest to you very briefly this morning is this. Even though our situation is very different, I think to handle our circumstances well, to handle those conversations well, to handle those interactions on social media well, we can learn much from Jesus's example. So what I want to do is just sketch out for you very briefly the three things that Jesus avoids that I think we can learn from. First of all, I want you to notice this. In this interaction, Jesus avoids political simplicity. He avoids political simplicity. Notice again how the question is framed. You see, the trap is framed as an either-or dilemma. You're either on one side or the other, and Jesus, you're going to be in trouble if you're in this box or in that box. So Jesus, which box is it? Do we pay the tax or not? Which side are you on? Who's right, the red states or the blue states? But what I want you to notice is that in the midst of this moment, which is deeply divided politically, Jesus refuses to be put neatly into a box. Jesus doesn't fit into their pre-existing categories. And I think we need to pay attention to this. Once again, I'm recognizing our situation is very different, but the truth is sometimes we put Jesus in a political box. You know what? If you're a good Christian, this is how you'll vote. I can't believe you voted for this candidate or you think this way on this political issue and you call yourself a Christian. But the reality is some of the cultural issues, political issues we face, you know, they're very complex. I was encouraged a couple of years ago, a group of scholars from the Brookings Institute, which is a left-leaning think tank, and scholars from the American Enterprise Institute, a right-leaning think tank, came together to form a study group on dealing with poverty in America. And they created a working study group together for a series of months and then produced a very helpful report with what I think are some creative ideas. Creative ideas that come from all dimensions of the political spectrum. And one of the things I appreciated in their executive summary at the beginning of their report was this. They made the comment together, no one side has a monopoly on the truth. And I highlight to say this. I think we, as Christians, we have to be careful about putting Jesus in a political box. Because Jesus refuses to be put into pre-existing categories. And we've got to acknowledge, for some people, I think this was very frustrating. I think there were those who felt, you know what, we are God's people. We need our people in leadership. Our government needs to reflect that. Jesus, we want you to bring a revolution. We want you to put Caesar down. But Jesus doesn't go there. Right? He's not forced into this simple understanding of political realities. And I think we need to pay attention to this, particularly as Americans, for this reason. Because woven deep into our history as Americans, going back to the earliest days of the colonies, is the idea fostered by some that America is in relationship to God just like Israel was in relationship with God. It's an idea really that goes back to the Puritans. You see it in different writings and in different ways. This idea has still been at work and still influences our politics, right? We're in relationship with God just like Israel was in relationship with God. And this has influenced us in different ways. I don't have time to really unpack this On your handout, I just highlight a book that I think is very helpful by evangelical historian John Wilsley on American exceptionalism. And if you'd like to read further, I'll commend that book to you. But this idea is still at work that, you know, Israel was in relationship with God, America is in relationship with God, and it influences our thinking in different ways. For instance, one of the things that it does is this. There are times when we talk about politics, particularly around an election cycle, it is so easy for Christians to take passages of scripture written to ancient Israel and apply them to America. So for instance, here's something we do. We around election season, we love this verse from 2 Chronicles 7. If my people called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land. Now hear me clearly. We absolutely are commanded in scripture to pray for those in authority. And I think with that comes the responsibility to pray for elections, to pray for our country. But here's where we get in trouble. We need to understand that this passage was written to Israel, a nation uniquely in covenant relationship with God. And in all of history, there has been only one nation uniquely in covenant relationship with God. Because with the coming of Christ, where is God's work now directed and focused? It's not, his plan of redemption is not any longer being carried out through this specific nation. Ultimately, where is his focus of work? It is now in his church. This is why Peter, writing to an early group of Christians, can say to them as the church, you are a chosen people. You are a holy nation. And the deal is, if we will understand that, if we understand that, no, America isn't exactly like Israel, I think it changes how we engage certain things politically. It brings down some of the fear that we can have about what's going on in our country, because we understand that God is ultimately at work through his church. Likewise, when we read a passage like this, particularly around election season, I think it just shouldn't challenge us to pray for our country. I think it ultimately should challenge us to pray this way. We need to pray for healthy churches. Because what our nation needs at a time of cultural pluralism, division, antagonistic rhetoric, what our country needs are churches populated by people individually and together who are deeply rooted in the gospel, who have a deep sense of who God is and what he's doing, and who are radically committed to living in and living out the transforming grace of God in all their spheres of influence. What Central Pennsylvania needs from us as Hershey Free is to be God's church. People who, as we gather and build relationships, are coming to just grow in our relationship with God and one another and grow in our understanding of how God is placing us in this community in intentional ways to live out the gospel. And if we get that, if we get a hold of that and how God is working, I think it will just bring down some of the fear and uncertainty when we think about politics and some of the cultural factors. It will change how we engage people that disagree with us. It will just take some of the edge off. Now, at this point, you might say, well, Georgia, are you then saying that Jesus is telling us we just kind of disengage from the public sphere, right? We just back off. We just need to be a healthy church. We don't have to worry about culture and politics, and it's, right? Well, notice, secondly, not only does Jesus avoid political simplicity, I think he also avoids political complacency. Because, right, he says this. He asks for the coin. And he says, well, whose image is on it? Well, that would be Caesar's. And then he says, well, you need to give back to Caesar what is Caesar's. And I think with that comes the expectation, you have a responsibility to engage government. Now for us to engage politics, the public sphere. We have an obligation. And arguably in Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2, where other Christian authors begin to kind of tease that out and explain that in a little more detail, they are building on what Jesus is saying here in this simple statement. Interestingly, Jesus changes the vocabulary in this conversation. You know, he's asked, do we pay this? But then he uses a different term when he says pay back. And it's possible that there's an edge to what Jesus is saying in that you have a civic responsibility, but it's not a blind loyalty. I think that's perhaps part of the extended meaning of what's going on here. But the reality is we are not to withdraw. We're not to withdraw from life in our community in different ways. We're not to withdraw from the public sphere. That will look differently for us. We'll be involved in politics in different ways. Some of you are going to be more active than others. Some of you have and will serve an elected office. But I think for all of us, there's the expectation we are to be engaged in the life of culture around us. Right? This is one of the reasons we're getting ready for October 22nd, when again, we get to go out and serve our community and really live out the gospel in very tangible ways. But once again, at this point, you might say, well, George, you just brought us back to the original problem. Because you might say, you know what, I am a person that I try to be engaged. There are different ways I try to be a part of our community. Many of you are serving different organizations. You're involved in, you know, kids' activities, community activities. And maybe you would also say, and I try to be really astute politically. I try to keep up. I pay attention. And that's where I really get angry, because I get angry at people who just say things they don't really know about. They repeat bullet points, or they just spout off ideas, or they get involved in name calling, and they don't really understand the issues. Well, that really leads us to the final thing that Jesus avoids. Jesus, he avoids political simplicity. He avoids political complacency. But he also avoids political superiority. Think about what Jesus does again, right? He doesn't answer the question. Instead, he says, okay, give me a coin. Well, okay, here's the coin. Now tell me again, whose image is this? Whose inscription is this? Why, Caesar's. Well, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, but to God what is God's. And there is something that isn't stated, but I actually think it's implied in what Jesus is saying. And I think it's absolute mastery. I mean, the more you just reflect on the words of Jesus, just slow down and begin really to listen to what he's saying. I mean, this is so profound, because here's what I think Jesus was ultimately intending for this person to hear. Now tell me again, whose image is this? Whose image is this? Well, it's Caesar's. Well, you need to give back to Caesar. You have a responsibility. You have civic duties that you cannot undermine. But here's what's unstated. Caesar's image is on the coin. Whose image is on you? And what is unstated, but I think implied, is this. Yes, Caesar's image is on this coin, and you have an obligation to engage in civic responsibilities. But you need to understand that ultimately God's image is imprinted on you. And therefore, your ultimate allegiance, the final authority in your life, isn't about political persuasion, political identity, political party. At the core of who you are, you have been created to worship God alone. And he should be the focus of your ultimate allegiance. And therefore, Jesus is saying this: I know you want me to be a revolutionary. And you're right. I am a revolutionary. But I am bringing about a revolution that is going to work far deeper than you could ever imagine. Because I am bringing about a revolution that is going to work at the very core of who you are. Because you have been imprinted, you have been stamped with God's image. but because of sin that's been tarnished and the relationship has been broken. And I have now come so that you can be reconnected with the one who should be your ultimate allegiance. I've come to forgive you, to recreate you, and to bring you back into relationship with God. And ultimately then, Jesus is saying that should influence how we engage politics. In talking about what this looks like, a helpful book that I have found, and once again, I'll recommend another book to you, is by Russell Moore. He's written a book called Onward, Engaging the Culture Without Losing the Gospel. And there's a phrase he uses in this book that I find very helpful in thinking about what Jesus is getting at. It's a phrase that is very useful in thinking through, okay, what are the implications of these big ideas in terms of how we talk about politics with other people? And the phrase, and this is really what I want to leave you with this morning, the phrase is this: it is convictional kindness. When we think about engaging others, particularly other people who disagree with us, we need to do so with convictional kindness. First of all, we need to be people of deep convictions, right? We need to be people who are deeply convicted about the reality of who God is and what he's doing through Jesus Christ. People who have deep convictions about the work of the gospel and the reality that our identity is found in that work. And this is so important because I think when you operate, when you interact from this deep conviction, it just gives you a certain quiet confidence. It just gives you the confidence to know that, you know, as I'm working hard, perhaps for certain issues and even issues in our community, and at times it feels like there are other factors and forces at work moving in different directions. It just gives you the confidence to know, yet God is still at work. When I have these hard conversations at times with people I disagree with, I don't have to be defensive. I don't have to be on edge. There should be this confidence in the reality that the gospel is at work and it won't be thwarted. Furthermore, you know, to be people of conviction is to have, I think, deep convictions about ourselves. Because when we're rooted in the gospel, we're also rooted in the truth that we are broken people who are now being transformed by Christ. And because I understand that, I realize I don't always get it right. I don't always know the perfect solution to these issues. And that should produce a certain humility in how I deal with others. So we need to be people of conviction. I think convictions about God, convictions about who we are, and maybe just one other conviction that I would highlight, we need to be people who have certain convictions about who the enemy truly is. You know, in this political climate, when there's such division and when we get so involved, it's so easy to see people at the other end of the political perspective as the enemy and to talk about them in those terms. But as Christians, we're not to go there. And I realize you say, but George, there's some people who approach politics from deeply anti-Christian motivations. And trust me, I get that. I get that more than you know. 20 years ago, if we'd had this conversation, I never would have thought religious liberty would become a hot button issue in our country. But it's here. And as a trustee of a Christian university and college, I want you to know that already colleges and universities across this country are spending thousands upon thousands of hours wrestling with how do we engage the changing climate concerning religious liberty. And already Christian colleges and universities are having to think through how to do their mission well in a changing cultural climate. It's here. I get it. I'm in the midst of it. You're absolutely right. There are people who engage politics from a very anti-Christian perspective. But even then, we need to know who the enemy is. Paul writing in Timothy, and Timothy, this young Christian leader, kind of at times I think above his head, and people are now experiencing opposition because they're coming to Christ. And what does Paul say when he's talking about those people? He says this. He said, they're not the enemy, they're people entrapped by the enemy. And when I understand who the enemy ultimately is as a Christian, it just changes how I engage other people. And out of these convictions, I think should flow a certain kindness in our interaction with others. Not a kindness that's just nice. Not a kindness that's just, I want to avoid conflict at all costs, because we're to be people of conviction. But a kindness that flows out of the gospel. A kindness that flows out of the truth that Jesus has challenged me to see that as his follower, everyone is my neighbor, right? Don't you remember that interaction? Okay, Jesus, you know, help me think about the neighbor. Who's my neighbor? And the underlying question was always this: so who isn't? Who are the people I can write off and dismiss? Who are the people I can just label and disregard because they disagree with me? But you know what? I'm now grounded in the gospel, and as a follower of Jesus, that has to affect how I engage talking about these issues with my family, with my kids, on social media. And there should be a kindness at work that flows out of these deep convictions about God and how I'm related to God and how he invites me to follow Christ. A conviction that says, you know what, I'm not just going to label people and dismiss them. I'm not just going to always think the best of the people who agree with me and the worst of those who disagree with me. I don't have to get caught up in that kind of thinking and that kind of interaction. I can engage those situations differently. So here's the phrase I just want to leave you with. It's this phrase, convictional kindness. And so my challenge to you, the next time you find yourself in one of those conversations, or you're reading something online and you're screaming back at the article on the screen, or you're, you know, something on Facebook, or something in social media, something on the news, just remember this phrase. If you're a follower of Christ, you've been invited and challenged to respond from a position of convictional kindness. God, what does convictional kindness look like in this conversation? Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Let's pray together. Gracious God, as we talked about this, I'm sure for many of us, we've experienced various levels of frustration over the last few months, this election cycle. Even if we're not particularly active in thinking about government and culture and politics, there have just been times that things have upset us and frustrated us. And at times, even in our own family and people around us. So I pray that this interaction from Jesus would just kind of give us a new lens, a new angle on how to deal with these situations well. I pray we would learn from his experience. I pray that we would learn to take seriously this challenge to convictional kindness. May that shape how we respond. In Jesus' name.